dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few of the people that we have had the privilege of interviewing over, better part of 12 years now, in the course of this program's history, who have understood the business of intelligence, for one thing, but also the nature of the war for the free world and our most serious challenges in it than our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. He is Captain James Fennell. He is no stranger to these microphones, but we are always grateful to him for bringing the expertise that he developed in a lifetime of service in the United States Navy, rising to the rank of captain and one of the senior intelligence professionals in the entire Pacific Command during his time as a naval intelligence officer. He is these days a senior fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, which I'm obliged to say is not associated with the Washington one, the original, we think of it, but it's an important organization, and he is doing incalculably important work there, and we're always appreciative of him taking time, especially for these hour-long conversations, which we're privileged to have with him today. Captain, it's so good to have you aboard. Welcome back, sir. I wanted to visit with you as a matter of some urgency, Captain, because last night, Tucker Carlson, well, to use an old intelligence phrase, I think broke the code on the threat that we are most ominously facing from communist China. And that's saying something, because as we'll discuss in the course of this program, there are lots of different aspects to this threat. But I did want you to talk, if you would, sir, about Professor Di Dongshang, a man who was quoted at some length in the course of Tucker's program last night using video from a speech that he gave on Chinese television last month. Tell us a little bit about what we know about this professor at Renmin University and what he said that was, if not surprising exactly, nonetheless shocking.
Yeah, according to their website, Professor Di Dongshang is an associate dean at the School of International Relations at Renmin University in China. And it appears that he gave a speech, as you mentioned, last month, where he's talking to a group of folks in Shanghai on a television program. And the title of it is called The Answers. And it was the topic for a panel discussion on will China's opening up in the financial sector attract Wall Street wolves? And in the course of his presentation, which is I think the full presentation was somewhat 23 minutes or so, but was about 7 minutes. It's been on a viral clip that's been shown around. He basically says that, the reason that we were able to resolve things so well from the period of 1992 to 2016 is because we had, quote unquote, old friends who were, had access to the core circles of power in the United States, both in the government and in Wall Street and other institutions. And then he goes on to talk about how they were able to, resolve previous problems before the Trump era because they had these, essentially contacts inside the government and inside Wall Street that would go to bat for the Chinese Communist Party whenever they needed something, and that had all been disrupted because of President Trump. And, he tells a story about how one example of how they were able to get access to a facility to host one of their people in an event at a place that had already been booked out, and then how they were able to have somebody who had been a member of an American citizen, but was also a dual citizen in China. And they used their power to influence and get the American business owner to change their mind and allow the Chinese to come in and host the event and push out whoever was going to speak previously.
Yeah. If I could just interrupt on that point, it was very interesting that he used a phrase, he attributed it to this individual who had worked her magic, shall we say, on the owner of Politics and Prose, which is a very prominent leftist bookseller here in Washington, D.C. She said, when asked how she had managed to make this appearance of the Chinese folks promoting Xi Jinping and his book, she had reasoned with him, which he proceeded to point out was an expression from The Godfather, and suggests that, as is you know so well, Captain Fennell, the Chinese want, reasoning meant coercing, meant euchering, meant incentivizing, shall we say, perhaps with, corrupt, transactions, because that's actually what this Professor D said. You know, if one bag of cash isn't enough, I give him another bag of cash. That's my way. I mean, it was really stunning. And one of the things that I guess I'd like you just to respond to, sir, is that the eminent China hand who features often in our programming here, Gordon Chang, said in the course of Tucker's program last night, these remarks were so redolent of the kind of arrogance and contempt and increasing aggressiveness of the Chinese elites these days, that it's a tell, I think you'd say, in the intelligence business, no?
Yeah, I think clearly it demonstrates that their confidence in their ability to do these things and get away with it, knowing that they have people, in their hip pocket for whatever reason, from blackmail or from just outright, bribery to other forms of coercion, that they're able to get away with this, and now they don't feel compelled at all to be shy or coy about it. And some may say, well, that's only a reaction because Trump has been so publicly hard on China these last 3 or 4 years. And I would just simply say, this professor mentions that, hey, we had our way with the Americans from 1992 to 2016. So this isn't just something that just came about. They've been doing this. And it's now where they feel confident enough to go on television in China and, have millions and millions of people watch them and talk about their ability. And I know in some circles, some other China hand circles have been watching some of the dialogue, and some of the folks that are, more sympathetic to China says, well, this is some, bluster and self-talk to the Chinese amongst themselves. They're lying to themselves. They like to promote themselves. And so we shouldn't take this too seriously. But the fact of the matter is that we've seen this play out in other areas, in other venues where China gets their way through all forms of coercion and access to government officials. And what comes to my mind is something completely different than this example that this professor talked about. But I think back to 2012.
Well, hold the thought, if you would, because I want to get into that in detail with you, and also the role that Wall Street has been playing in all of this, which he laid out in, no uncertain terms, including as it related to transactions with Hunter Biden. All of that and more in our continuing conversation with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, also a founding member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and truly one of our country's duty experts on the matter of what the Chinese Communist Party is all about and what it might mean for you. We'll be right back with more with Captain Fennell, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Our guest this hour is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a distinguished naval intelligence officer who was the assistant director of intelligence for the Pacific Fleet before he retired from the Navy. He's an extraordinary resource. We're always delighted to have him with us, sir. You were about to tell us a story about the arrogance of the Chinese at the moment, beyond this episode that is recounted in this speech by this professor, Di Dongsheng. Go ahead, sir, if you would.
Sure, Frank. To me, when I hear something like this video, I then immediately start saying, well, let's see if we can prove this in other venues and other examples of where China has done things. And so, to me, with my focus on the Chinese military and what they've been doing inside the South China Sea, it brings me back to the spring of 2012 and what happened at Scarborough Shoal when, China confronted the Philippines at Scarborough Shoal, which is about 140 miles from Manila, and they sent down 10, 12 ships to basically scare off the Filipinos from their own exclusive economic zones and their own economic resources at the shoal. And at that time, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, Kirk Campbell, became an interlocutor between the Philippines and the PRC and basically arranged an agreement that both the Filipinos and the Chinese would leave the shoal on June 15th, 2012. And when June 15th came around, the Filipinos dutifully left, kept their word, and the Chinese didn't. And for the last 8 years, you know, the Filipinos and much of Asia's wondered what the hell happened. And maybe now we know what happened, that we know that somehow that the Chinese were able to, reason with Mr. Campbell on some kind of an agreement that turned out to be a disaster for American national security in the region.
I want to get into this in more detail with you in a moment, Captain. But as I recall, Joe Biden was personally charged with trying to negotiate with the Chinese about these waters, these atolls, and what they were beginning to do at the time to build what ultimately came to be fortified bastions on those islands. And you've pointed out on this program and elsewhere, I think, Jim, that some of these are the size of Pearl Harbor. And we, of course, are in the week in which we commemorate the Japanese surprise attack on that major American facility out in the Pacific. You served there for many years. That's a lot of real estate, a lot of airfields, a lot of port facilities, is it not? And just remind us, when we acquiesced, basically, to the Chinese taking them over, what that has meant in terms of the ability of the Chinese to project power and perhaps control both the waters and airspace above them, vital part of the world.
Yeah, Frank, it's 3,200 square kilometers or square, kilometers of land that the Chinese built down there. And as you said, three of those islands that they built are the size of Pearl Harbor with 10,000 foot runways and major pier space to put in at least two, Nimitz size aircraft carriers at the pier side. And so it's a major development. And after the Scarborough event from April to June 2012, we then saw the Chinese launch into building these seven islands. And we did nothing, and we backed off, and we were told not to provoke China and not to get close and not to interfere. And that's really transformed the balance of military power there, so much so that even the commander of the Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Davidson, in the last year or two, stated that, you know, China has now the military advantage in the South China Sea. And the presence there on a daily basis, it outnumbers the United States at 5 or 10 to 1 on any given day in terms of warships and aircraft and things of that nature. So it's our inability to confront China then in 2012 has had dramatic impact on the Chinese ability to project military power throughout the South China Sea and put at risk trillions of dollars of the world's economy at any given time.
Yeah, which transit those waters or airspace. Captain, again, I want to come back to some of these strategic and military topics with you as we progress, but just stay with this moment. 2012 was squarely in the window that Professor De Dongsheng talked about, in which he essentially gloated about the success of China's, quote, old friends, unquote, in the American elite, notably the political establishment, the media, I think, certainly in the mix here. But most especially, he cited and referred several times to Wall Street and the role that Wall Street played, basically going from the 70s until Donald Trump came to office, in managing U.S.-China relations to the distinct advantage of the Chinese Communist Party. Whenever there was a problem, the embassy gets bombed in Belgrade. The Chinese deliberately take down an American surveillance aircraft in international waters and so on. These things, he says, you know, those crises go away within 2 months because of the influence of China's old friends. Talk a little bit about what you have perceived is the role, for example, the folks on Wall Street and other business leaders in essentially acting as agents of influence for the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, Frank, I think it's very clear that, going back to the early 90s, that there were many people inside the United States that saw China as a golden goose that would lay these golden eggs because of the fact that they could get things produced without any labor costs compared to an American labor cost. And as we saw over those decades, they offshored manufacturing in the United States and moved it to China, and they've become dependent upon that, and they're adamant that that's where their future lies. And I thought it was ironic that the same day that this video comes out on Tucker Carlson's show, on the front page of China Daily, their top article is joint efforts urged to mend Sino-US ties. And it talks about China and the U.S. should work together to seek a resumption of dialogue and put bilateral ties back on track and rebuild mutual trust in the next phase, as Beijing expects and believes Washington's China policy will regain objectivity and rationality. And then they go through, and it's a webinar, it's a Zoom call with the foreign minister, Wang Yi, with a bunch of American Wall Street experts from General Motors, FedEx, Visa, Qualcomm. The very day that this video comes out, where a Chinese professor talks about how they influence Wall Street to do China's bidding, the Communist Party's bidding, the Chinese Communist Party says, oh, by the way, we're talking to Wall Street again in public and we're working with them. So they're not even hiding it. It's just outrageous.
Even worse, today, Beijing rewarded one of what I call Beijing's bankers and preeminent Wall Street agents of influence, a company called Goldman Sachs, with the first of promised opportunities for these investment firms in the United States to wholly own subsidiaries in China. So this is a very tangible reward, for one thing, it would seem, as well as a further inducement to Wall Street, if any were needed, to expand their use of American investors' monies to underwrite the Chinese Communist Party's operations. And interestingly enough, as you know, I'm sure, Captain Fennell, on Saturday of this past weekend, the State Department issued essentially a roster of Chinese companies and their subsidiaries doing business in the United States, including many of them in our capital markets, in our index funds, in the so-called exchange-traded funds that wrap those index funds, these are terms of art in Wall Street, that are actually sanctioned by the United States government on the entities list of of the Commerce Department, or the Pentagon's new list of what they call Chinese communist military companies, or both. And this would seem to be a very inopportune moment, to say the least, for Wall Street to be expanding its presence in China, point one, and point two, for this professor to be pointing out that these are essentially running dogs, to use the Chinese phrase, the communist phrase, for the Chinese Communist Party, no?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we're seeing just almost a total disregard for national security from the American business community. In another article today in China Daily, they talk about the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai stating that the Chinese economy has recovered from the pandemic, and we see reflected in exports of manufactured goods, blah, blah, blah. But basically saying it's a perfect time for America to double down and reinvest even more money in China. So, we're two diametrically opposed views. And what's the missing element here is, what does that money that gets invested in China go to? And it doesn't just go into these commercial ventures, but some part of that money, a cut of that, goes into the PLA, which makes weapons to attack us and our allies.
Well, and as you know so well, and we have to take a short break. We'll be right back to talk about this a bit further. But there is this phenomenon that the director of national intelligence most recently warned about last week in an important editorial in the Wall Street Journal, in which he described the so-called civil-military fusion, which essentially puts at the disposal of the Chinese Communist Party, not just the military, but the Chinese Communist Party more generally, essentially anything that any company has, proprietary information, maybe that they stole from us, trade secrets, what have you. We're going to talk about the implications of that so-called fusion with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired, on the other side of this very short break. We'll be right back.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're talking with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired, now a senior fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, and a founding member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, I'm very proud to say. Jim, there's so much to talk with you about, and I want to come back to some of the things that are really in your wheelhouse, specifically to get your take on, generally, the importance of this essay by the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe. I don't know if you've caught some of the appearances that he's had on American television in its aftermath, including Tucker's show last night, Maria Bartiromo's over the weekend. But he's been amplifying on the warnings about the nature of the Chinese threat. Specifically, I think it's fair to say, the Chinese Communist Party is the engine behind that threat. It sounds an awful lot like Jim Fennell's warnings for a couple of decades. How do you feel about this kind of vindication? I suspect you, like me, would rather be wrong about most of these things than right, but there has to be some satisfaction that the senior leadership of our country has finally awakened to the problem and is now taking seriously, as the DNI has put it, his job to warn the American people about what you've been telling us is coming.
Well, Frank, yes. I mean, it is somewhat personally gratifying to see Director Ratliff's Wall Street Journal report and his statement that the intelligence is clear. Beijing intends to dominate the United States and the rest of the planet economically, militarily, and technologically. I have been saying that for a long time, and I'm glad to see it, but I wish I was wrong, because it's going to mean that we cannot just continue to do what we've always been doing. And I see his statement as kind of a completion of this administration's, from the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the FBI, the Attorney General, the Vice President, the President, and now the Director of National Intelligence. Kind of putting a bookend on this, of clearly and unambiguously stating what the intelligence reveals. And you have to ask yourself, why is he saying this now, and where have our previous directors of national intelligence been over the last decade or two? Because this didn't just happen overnight. And so one has to go back and ask themselves, where was General Clapper during his illustrious years as the director of national intelligence, and how come he didn't mention this ever one time? And so I think we need to talk to ourselves about, one, the intelligence community and the politicization of the intelligence community. And then secondly, we need to say to ourselves, so what are we going to do about this? Because we cannot just simply state it now and say, okay, and now we know it, and just go back and continue to do business as usual. That's not going to work.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see whether that is what we will get from those that Joe Biden has been designating to serve him, should he become president of the United States, something that is, I believe, far from resolved at the moment. But it is important for us to be doing some stock taking. Given my old boss Ronald Reagan's famous dictum that personnel is policy, I want to sort of vet a number of the people that the president-elect so-called, has been rolling out as senior subordinates, should he come to office. Let's start with Averill Haynes. Jim, I don't know if you ever worked with her when you were in government, but what do we know about her? She has been tapped by the, again, so-called president-elect to become his first director of national intelligence.
I have not worked with her. And what I know is that she's got a, you know, a background working with the previous, Obama administration's deputy national security advisor, and she was also deputy director of CIA. All I can say is that, you know, my position on this is if we go into a new administration with new personnel, and these personnel have associations with the Obama administration, like she does, that we need to place demands on these people to prove that they're not going to go along and resume what they did during the Obama years, which was to accommodate and appease the PRC. And I'm told by people that I talk to in Washington in the intelligence community that they believe that there's a bipartisan effort to, you know, really now we understand the threat from China. Well, that may be true. I'm not convinced yet. And I think we need to hold these people to stand up and make demonstrable actions, not just statements, but demonstrable actions to show that they're not going to appease the PRC. For instance, they shouldn't be allowed to say, hey, we're going to reinvite the PLA Navy to the Rim of the Pacific exercise in 2024 or something like that. They've got to come out and say, we're not going to continue the same actions. Otherwise, I don't trust them, and I don't trust what they're saying, and I think that they're going to go back to what we hear rumors of this Restoration 2020 group that wants to restore the U.S.-China relationship before Trump, which was, as I said, to accommodate and appease and non-provoke the PRC.
You know, there is reason to be skeptical, that's for sure, and whether it's Restoration 2020 or it's the global reset. We've certainly seen those, notably on Wall Street, as Di Dingcheng said, basically, you know, licking their chops at the prospect of having such people in office. It was absolutely palpable, I have to say, when he came to the Biden ascendancy in his remarks. Professor Di, you know, and his audience, by the way, were very excited about the prospect that they had a guy who Gordon, I think, among others of us, believe is deeply compromised, as witnessed or evidenced by Hunter Biden's laptop, by those transactions, as the professor called it. But let's go into a little bit more in the background of some of these other individuals. Jake Sullivan is the fellow who is supposedly going to be the national security advisor. As I recall, Captain Fennell, he was a very vocal enthusiast for Joe Biden's view that rising China was going to be a really good thing, not just for the Chinese, but for all of us. Have I misremembered that, or is that of concern to you as well?
That's definitely a concern, Frank, and that is the quote that he had, and his association with Westex and their association with, you know, helping American firms, you know, do business in China, and this idea, again, from Wall Street that, you know, what's best for us is to have all of our companies, our major corporations and others, you know, invested in China, because that will, you know, somehow be perversely interpreted as beneficial to Americans, because that'll be an American corporation with investments in China. And, you know, as the director of national intelligence said, I mean, it's the Chinese are about robbing, you know, robbing and replacing our technologies and our manufacturing and our corporations. And I don't see the people that are the Wall Street types fully understanding the national security implications of this just headlong rush into engaging with China as if it was a benign entity.
That's probably too charitable. It's not so much that they don't seem to fully understand it. It really seems as though they don't give a fig about it. You know, that's just not going to get in the way of their money making calculations. And to this point, Jim, one of the things that we have been impressed by in a fact sheet that the State Department issued, I mentioned earlier, on Saturday warning American investors that these Chinese companies were going to be sanctioned and they were going to lose money, and impressing upon these indexes and ETFs, as they're called, to get out of these companies, was the fact that some who advocate such companies being held in indexes and indexes with them in it being held in portfolio are some of America's top companies, including, I think it said, the top 10 defense contractors pension funds have these indexes replete with maligned, not just Chinese companies, maligned Chinese companies. This suggests that even people in the national security business, Jim Fennell, aren't paying attention to the problem here, and in fact are making it worse with such investments in the Chinese Communist Party. No,
I agree, Frank. And I think in a way, this is why there was such a reversion over the last few years to the word decoupling, because I think many of these people just can't contemplate the implications or how to actually decouple. And, you know, sometimes people overanalyze things and you just have to, you know, cut the cord or cut the, you know, they say fish or cut bait. And I think it's time to cut the bait and get out.
I couldn't agree more. Interestingly enough, you talked about bipartisanship, Jim. Something that was remarkable took place about 2 weeks ago, I guess now. The United States House of Representatives joined the United States Senate, which had acted back in May, in unanimously approving legislation that would strip Chinese companies from access to our capital markets if they did not submit to audits. This is a preferential or sweetheart deal that Joe Biden, interestingly enough, was responsible for bringing about back in 2013. To your point about bipartisanship and whether it's likely to be real and enduring if we find pressure from China, as we will, of course, and from its friends and old friends, especially in the elite, pressing for a reversion to full-on engagement with China, it will be very interesting to see whether this bipartisanship, you know, amounts to anything. I think even in this case, it was probably explainable by the fact that they had 3 years, the Chinese did, to get right with this auditing stuff. So it may have been much ado about not very much. But the point, Jim, is this. You are now being, I think, fully vindicated in terms of what you have seen coming. And in our last block, which we'll turn to in just a moment, we're going to talk about what the failure of our country to attend to your warnings to this point has meant in terms of the facts that whoever is going to be the next commander-in-chief is going to have to confront and contend with. We'll talk about that with Captain Fennell right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily important and I think timely conversation with one of our country's leading experts on the Chinese Communist Party and both the threat that it poses to us in the military arena and in the forms of what the Chinese call other unrestricted warfare vectors. And we're going to touch on several of them before we let Captain James Fennell go. But before we do that, Jim, just another quick question on personnel. I don't know, again, whether during your long time of service in uniform, you had an opportunity to work with or observe at least the man who also served, I guess, some four decades in the uniform of the United States Army. It seems mostly in the Middle East, though, namely General Lloyd Austin, who the would-be president-elect has tapped to be his defense secretary if he comes to office. Do you know anything about him? Have you worked with him? What are your thoughts about this selection?
Frank, I do not know General Austin. Our paths never crossed during my almost 30 years. Looking at his resume and his background, I see that he's clearly, you know, done honorable service in the CENTCOM AOR. I would be interested in who he will bring in to advise him on the Pacific and the Indo-Pacific, given his obvious, I think, lack of, in-person experience in the region. So that'll be something to watch for.
It will indeed. And I think we all will be. And hopefully, as you said about all of these folks, including, by the way, Tony Blinken, to be the Secretary of State, that should they be actually in a position to be subjected to Senate advice and consent, their confirmation hearings will feature this very important issue of China front and center. So let's go back to the military problem. You touched on earlier, Jim, the fact that the Chinese Navy is now not only the largest in the world, but given that our Navy, substantially smaller than its now, but still quite capable, nonetheless has to operate essentially all over the world, giving rise to force-on-force ratios that are very disadvantageous to us. Give us a flavor of just how bad that is. And also, Jim, if you would, the effect of all this civil-military fusion on the qualitative edge that has been so important to our ability to safeguard our interests and those of our allies and friends in far reaches like the Western Pacific.
Well, Frank, I think, you know, there's this internal debate that goes on in Washington about, you know, what is the size of the U.S. Navy and why do we focus on the number of hulls versus some other metric? And even in the last few weeks, you had retired Vice Admiral Joe Sestak writing a screed that said that, the number of hulls is immaterial. It's a warfighting capability and we need to focus on cyber. And the fact of the matter is, no one has ever argued that it's just the number of hulls that matter. It's about the total ability to bring firepower from our Navy against any other Navy in the world. And you can't achieve that end state to be able to defeat the PRC Navy, the PLA Navy, in a major sea battle with the force of what we have today. We're on 292 ships. And so this administration set the goal of 350 ships, and even the previous Secretary of Defense mused on maybe we really need a 500 ship Navy. And just this last week, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Army General, General Milley said, you know, we're going to have to put more of our money into building our Navy. And he said, I'm an Army guy, but I can see that. So I think there's a general recognition that if we don't do something to reinstill our naval industrial shipbuilding base, that we're already in serious trouble, and we could be in such trouble that it could be the end of America as we know it in terms of having a Navy that protects our interests. And so all these people from Wall Street that we've been talking about, who just seem to think that everything's going to go on forever as it always has, have no concept of what it means not to control the seas. And right now we're right at this break point where China's Navy is actually bigger than ours. They have some serious challenges ahead. They don't have the global reach that we have today. But they're working on it, and they've been diligently working on it for two decades. And they're in a position in terms of their shipbuilding infrastructure to be able to outproduce us as they have for the last at least half decade, if not a decade. They're in a position to do that for another decade or two decades at least. And at the end of that point, if you get up to, say, another decade from now in 2030, they're on order to be near a 600-ship Navy, while we may not even be at 300. And at that point, it's going to dramatically alter the balance of power around the globe.
And what that means is not just the ability to project that power, Captain Fennell, as you know so well. It means an ability to go back to what we talked about earlier, to reason with people, to coerce them, to compel them, not necessarily by using force, but by the mere threat of it, to do what they want, which is, as you've described it so well for so long, to dominate the world, to make everybody else do what the Chinese want. And so that brings us to this point, Jim. Again, if the Chinese have 600 ships, they will not only have plenty to dominate us in the theater, the AOR, as you call it, in the Western Pacific, area of operation, area of responsibility. What's the R stand for? Area of responsibility. But also in a lot of other places besides, places that we think we also have vital interests, places that as a maritime nation, we want to be and we want to see, you know, our access undiminished and the like. So this brings me to the point about the qualitative edge as well as the number of hulls, Jim. How, as you look at what has been happening with the Chinese stealing defense technologies, making off with enormous quantities of our intellectual property and otherwise essentially greatly reducing the cost to them of getting the state-of-the-art technology and incorporating it into their forces, their civilian, you know, competitive companies as well, of course, but specifically talking here about the military threat, into their forces far faster than we are able to do. How does that leave us if there's not only a quantitative problem, but a qualitative one as well?
Right. I think the people that make this argument about numbers, they have no knowledge of, it's not just the numbers, it is the quality of the platforms that the Chinese are putting out. The Chinese have a fleet of warships that have anti-ship cruise missiles that outrange any anti-ship cruise missile that's in the United States Navy. And the Chinese are not just sitting along and looking at producing a Navy of a 1970s or 80s vintage. They're producing a 21st century Navy that's taking all of the work that we talk about in our distributed maritime network operations, and they're instilling that into their own fleet. Just this last week, they launched the 14th Gaofeng Earth Observation Satellite, a low Earth orbit satellite. These satellites, when I retired 5 years ago, I think they had three of them. Now they have 14 that provides, you know, near universal coverage of the maritime domain and allows them to find and fix and track U.S. Navy warships at sea. And they're looking for submarines as well. And so it's not that the Chinese are building ships, and that's all I'm talking about. They're building ships that have sophisticated communications equipment that are networked with their own indigenous satellite intelligence system. They have communications now. We're seeing reports about this new quantum computing and new quantum communications that offers in the next decade to allow them to have the ability to communicate without that being broken by normal traditional, encryption devices and so or de-encryption devices. So they're going to be able to operate at will with assured communications, with weapons that are more sophisticated and advanced than ours are. And they're going to be able to operate in many other places around the globe where we won't be able to cover. And we're already seeing our forces stretched to the breaking point. And you've seen some of those pictures of some of our ships coming back to port after months at sea looking, you know, like a rust bucket. And things that would have never occurred a decade ago or two decades ago or more.
It has to break your heart as a seasoned naval officer to see the state of our Navy, but more generally, the state of our preparedness to deal with these Chinese threat vectors across the broadest imaginable front. At the very least, Jim Fennell, I think there is comfort that we seem to be awakening to this problem. I pray, personally, that we will have 4 more years to get it right and take corrective action. It will be the end of our republic, I fear, if we don't. But that's something we'll be covering in the days ahead with your help, among others. Jim Fennell, thank you for your service to our country, both that in uniform and that you are continuing to render these days, among other places, at the Committee on the Present Danger, China. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you come back to us again soon, sir. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.